Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is November 1st, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, Can TPA Be a Bridge Over Troubled Waters to Mechanical Thrombectomy? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Michael Krawczyk. He is in his fifth year of neurology residency at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. He is interested in acute neurologic illness, including cerebrovascular disease and epilepsy. Next year, he will be beginning a neurohospitalist fellowship at the University of Texas at Houston. Welcome to the SGEM, Michael.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we need to clear things up right up front. This episode between a neurologist and an emergency physician.
Let's get ready to rumble!
We're not going to be debating the issue of TPA alone for acute ischemic stroke. That is a separate issue, which we've talked about quite a bit on Twitter, but also neurologists and EM doctors have been discussing this for decades.
I completely agree. I think it'll take us at least an entire episode to go through that literature appropriately.
Yeah, and I don't think I have the bandwidth or the file size that could accommodate all of that. But here you are at my home, otherwise known as the Bat Cave. And I think it was said in the 70s, only Nixon could go to China. So I really appreciate you coming over and covering a neurology emergency medicine paper with me on acute ischemic stroke.
Thanks again for inviting me.
Well, let's set the table here and give us a case.
So the case is a 70-year-old male with a past medical history of hypertension, peripheral artery disease. He was last seen normal 1.5 hours ago. He's presenting with acute onset of aphasia and right-sided face and arm weakness. He has an NIHSS score, which is a National Institute of Health scale stroke scale of 7. At 1 a.m., a CT angiogram is obtained that demonstrated a left M2 occlusion with an ASPECT score, which is an Alberta Stroke Program early CT score, of 10. Given the recent publication of trials assessing if mechanical thrombectomy alone is non-inferior to a bridging approach with TPA in addition to mechanical thrombectomy, you wonder whether these trials apply to your patient and what is the best course of action.
Well, thanks for setting things up. Let's go through some background information. There are two treatments for acute ischemic stroke. You have systemic, TPA, and mechanical thrombectomy. Now, we have covered some studies looking at both of these treatment modalities on the SGEM.
Mechanical thrombectomy is indicated only for patients with large vessel occlusions on imaging. There were a few earlier studies on mechanical thrombectomy that failed to demonstrate superiority, but it was the study Mr. Clean published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2015 that really changed practice. It was a multi-center, randomized, unblinded trial treating 500 patients with an anterior circulation large vessel occlusion within 6 hours of symptom onset. The primary outcome was a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 2 at 90 days, and it showed an absolute difference of 14% favoring mechanical thrombectomy. This gives a number needed to treat of 7.
Well, 6 RCTs have been published since that big Mr. Clean trial, and they all supported mechanical thrombectomy, and all were stopped early. So there was the Swift Prime, Extend IA, RevasCAD, Escape, Dawn, Diffuse, all these names. So they had 6 randomized trials published since Mr. Clean, and all supported this therapy.
Mm-hmm. For patients with large vessel occlusions, it is unclear whether there is any additional benefit with administering TPA before thrombectomy. This is also known as a bridging approach. This is in contrast to skipping TPA and directly proceeding with mechanical thrombectomy.
And there are several theoretic advantages to a bridging approach. These potential advantages include thrombus debulking, allowing easier clot retrieval, distal emboli lysis, recannulization prior to mechanical thrombectomy, and it may be beneficial in cases of unsuccessful mechanical thrombectomy. Conversely, a direct-to-mechanical thrombectomy approach may lead to fewer intercerebral hemorrhages and quicker initiation of EVT.
Recently, 3 randomized control non-inferior trials on this topic have been published. 2 from China, called Direct MT and the DEVT trial, and 1 from Japan called the SKIP trial. Two trials demonstrated non-inferiority, while one trial failed to show that direct mechanical thrombectomy was a non-inferior approach.
So, Michael, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
What is the best strategy for treating patients with an acute large vessel occlusion? Direct to mechanical thrombectomy or a bridging approach with TPA followed by mechanical thrombectomy?
And what's the reference?
Reference is Katsanos and colleagues. The title of the article is Utility of Intravenous Alteplase Prior to Endovascular Stroke Treatment, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of Randomized Control Trials, published in the journal Neurology of this year, 2021.
Yeah, this paper came out in August of 2021. So let's go through the PICO. What was the population of the patients in this study?
Randomized control trials of patients with acute large vessel occlusion stroke qualifying for mechanical thrombectomy.
Yeah, and then they excluded observational studies and studies that were non-randomized trials. What was the intervention?
Mechanical thrombectomy alone.
And what did they compare it to?
Mechanical thrombectomy bridged with TPA.
All right, so let's go through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome of interest?
It was a modified Rankin scale score of 0 to 2 at 3 months.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
There were several. There was a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 1 and ordinal shift at 3 months, successful recanalization before mechanical thrombectomy, successful recanalization after mechanical thrombectomy, randomization to puncture time, symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, and any ICH, and all-cause mortality.
Okay, so the author's conclusions were, quote, "We detected no difference in functional outcomes of IV thrombolysis-eligible patients with an acute LVO receiving direct endovascular thrombectomy compared to BT or bridging thrombectomy. Because uncertainty for most endpoints remain large and the available data are not able to exclude the possibility of overall benefit or harm, further randomized control trials are needed." End of quote. Okay, for therapeutic systematic reviews, we have 7 quality checklist questions. Let's run through those now. The first question, the clinical question is sensible and answerable.
Yes.
Do you think the search for studies was detailed and exhaustive?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think it was that hard. There was only 3 that were recently published too. The primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
I'd say no, there were some concerns.
The assessment of the studies, were they reproducible?
Yes.
Were the outcomes clinically relevant?
Yes.
Was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome?
There was, but only in the analysis of procedural and puncture access complications was there statistical heterogeneity.
All right, and the 7th and final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
All right, let's go through the results then, Michael. There were 3 RCTs included, and they had a total of almost 1,100 patients. The median age was in the early 70s, and 42% were female. What was the key result?
No statistical difference in good neurological outcome.
Okay, let's dig into those outcomes. That primary outcome was the modified Rankin scale score of 0 to 2 at 3 months. What did they find?
The odds ratio was 1.08. And it was not significant, and the adjusted odds ratio was 1.11, and it was also not significantly different.
All right, let's go through the secondary outcomes. They didn't find statistical difference for almost all of their secondary outcomes, except for 2. What were the 2, Michael?
The 2 were successful recanalization before EVT. There was an odds ratio of 0.37, and for any ICH, and there was an odds ratio of 0.67.
Okay, that's enough of the results. Now it's time to talk a little nerdy, Michael. And you know, after interacting with me on Twitter, I'm full on nerd. So let's go through 5 things about this study that we wanted to pull out. And I'll start it off with external validity. All 3 trials, like you mentioned earlier, were from Asia, and as such, may not be directly applicable to a North American population and healthcare system. And in one of the trials, they used 0.6 milligrams per kilogram of TPA. That was the SKIP trial, instead of the standard 0.9 milligrams per kilogram. And this could bias the findings towards non-inferiority. In addition, these studies were all conducted at stroke centers with mechanical thrombectomy available and do not address the drip and then ship to a stroke center model of care.
The second limitation is the non-inferiority margins that were chosen. So all three studies included in the meta-analysis were non-inferior trial designs. They were asking if direct to mechanical thrombectomy was non-inferior to the standard bridging with TPA before mechanical thrombectomy. Two of the three trials, direct MT and the DEVT trial, the non-inferiority was met, but the non-inferiority margin was set at equal or less than 10% absolute clinical effect in the DEVT trial and 20% effect size and odds ratio in the direct MT trial. Even if non-inferiority is demonstrated, it still does not mean there's no clinical benefit from a bridging approach if the non-inferiority margin is too large, which may represent a clinically important difference. Many argue that the non-inferiority claim should only be reserved with a less conservative margin of 5%. None of these trials met this less conservative margin.
Yeah, that's a really important point. When you're looking at non-inferiority trials, looking at what did they decide they would consider non-inferior? Because non-inferiority has clinical implications. And just because something does or doesn't meet some statistical measure, and they set the delta, which is the non-inferiority margin, at a certain level, doesn't inform us of whether it will be clinically significant. That needs to be interpreted. Now, the third thing we wanted to bring up was performance bias. And we've discussed different forms of bias many times on the AskGem. This is the first time we've mentioned performance bias. This type of bias is defined by the Cochrane Risk of Bias tool as the result of, quote, systematic differences between groups in the care that is provided or in exposure to factors other than the interventions of interest, end of quote.
As highlighted by the authors of this meta-analysis, there was a performance bias in the direct MT trial, with 9.4% of patients in the bridging group not receiving mechanical thrombectomy, while only 5.2% in the direct group did not receive mechanical thrombectomy. This 4.2% difference may have resulted in worse outcomes in the bridging approach, favoring direct mechanical thrombectomy and a finding of non-inferiority.
All right, let's go on to a more familiar bias. So this is point three. This is selection bias. This is a type of bias we've discussed many times on the AskGem. The Cochrane Risk of Bias tool defines selection bias as the result of, quote, systemic differences between baseline characteristics of the groups that are compared, end of quote. Selection bias may affect the estimate of the per protocol effect and or the intention to treat effect. It depends on the definition that is used for the groups that are being compared.
In the DEVT trial, an exclusion criteria was arterial tortuosity and or other arterial disease that would prevent the device from reaching the target vessel. This exclusion criteria may effectively cherry-pick patients, excluding those where thrombectomy would have been difficult, potentially resulting in less favorable outcome in the direct mechanical thrombectomy group. It is unclear how many patients were excluded from the DVT trial for this reason. In comparison, in the direct mechanical thrombectomy trial, approximately 5.8% of patients intended to undergo thrombectomy did not due to technical reasons, highlighting that even in specialized academic centers, thrombectomy remains technically challenging.
All right, the fourth point we wanted to bring up was about the timing of the TPA. In the SKIP trial, 21% of the patients in the bridging group had TPA started after groin puncture for mechanical thrombectomy. It is likely that in a significant portion of these patients, mechanical thrombectomy was completed even before the TPA infusion was completed. In the direct MT trial, 87% of the patients had a TPA infusion ongoing during mechanical thrombectomy, and 9% of the patients in the bridging group did not receive the full dose of TPA. This could have biased the study for a finding of non-inferiority for mechanical thrombectomy alone.
The fifth limitation are subgroups. Certain subgroups that may have benefited from a bridging approach were underrepresented in the three trials. In the study design of the DVT and SKIP trials, they did not include patients with M2 occlusions. After final adjudication, the percentage of M2 occlusions in the DVT trial was 1.7%, SKIP 19%, and in the direct MT trial, 10.1%. It is known that compared to M1 and ICA occlusions, TPA is much more effective at lysing M2 clots. In the INTERSECT study, which was a prospective study, the odds ratio of recanalization with TPA of an IC occlusion was 1, proximal M1 occlusion was 1.99, and an M2 occlusion was 3.61.
The key word in that previous paragraph, Michael, is may. And it could have also been read, may not.
I completely agree with you. It's unclear which approach is better for M2 occlusions. The argument is that two out of the three trials did not include M2 occlusions based on an occlusion criteria. And as a result, the amount of M2 occlusions overall was low. Therefore, it may be unwise in expecting a similar outcome that was observed in these trials in patients with M2 occlusions, as they were excluded from the majority of the trials that we are discussing. And there is a rationale based on previous research to suggest that patients with M2 occlusions may do better with a bridging approach.
Well, in addition, recannulization would be a surrogate marker for good neurologic function. Just because blood flow is restored does not mean function will necessarily improve. This would be true if the damage was too great, regardless of the time.
I also agree with that. Recanalization is a surrogate marker of outcome, and as you mentioned, there is such a thing as futile recanalization. I would just add that recanalization is a variable strongly associated with better outcome. After all, the entire point of thrombectomy is to pull out the clot. There is no conceivable benefit of thrombectomy without recanalization. The benefits of tPA are strongly associated with earlier times of treatment. Another point is that neither direct MT or DVT trial had any patients receiving tPA under 2 hours. The approximate median time for both trials from symptom onset to tPA treatment was 3 hours. This is in contrast to the Hermes meta-analysis. This is a meta-analysis of 5 endovascular trials that were previously mentioned. The symptom onset to tPA treatment was 2.08 hours, approximately 1 hour shorter compared to direct MT or the DVT trial. A partial explanation for this is the less than ideal door-to-needle times in the direct and DVT trial of approximately 60 minutes. The Hermes investigators demonstrated that a 1 hour delay in door-to-needle times is associated with 53% lower odds of functional independence in large vessel occlusion patients treated with tPA. The unfavorable effect of such a delay may have led to an underestimation of the benefit of a bridging approach.
Now, we always need to be cautious about not overinterpreting observational data. There are no randomized control trials randomizing patients into you're going to get treated early or you're going to get treated late. So there could be unmeasured confounders responsible for the associations that we observe with the faster times and better outcomes. Perhaps those teams that perform faster also do several other things better and faster, and those are what is responsible for the observed improvements.
The concept of time is brain, that is to say that brain tissue, since the onset of a stroke is irreversibly lost unless reperfusion is achieved in a timely manner, is initially based on animal studies. If the middle cerebral artery is occluded in monkeys or other animals, the duration of ischemia is directly related to the volume of infarct up to a certain time point, but not longer. These experiments really form the basis of our understanding of core and penumbra physiology and define thresholds of cerebral ischemia.
And it was Dr. Camilo Gomez who coined the term time is brain back in 1993. That's before I started practicing medicine. Dr. Gomes has modified his position to, quote, it is no longer reasonable to believe that the effect of time on ischemic process represents an absolute paradigm. It's increasingly evident that the volume of injured tissue within a given interval after the estimate time of onset shows considerable variability, in large part due to the beneficial effects of a robust collateral circulation. And he made that quote in 2018.
I agree with that statement of Dr. Gomez. Time to treatment is not an absolute paradigm. And there are other important variables such as collateral circulation that can perfuse the ischemic penumbra and slow core progression. Currently, at stroke onset, we cannot predict which patients are slow or fast progressors. Even in patients that are slow progressors, over time the ischemic core grows. From DAWN and DIFFUSE trials, we know that the upper limit is 24 hours, but some even argue that in a minority of slow progressors benefit from reperfusion can be up to 48 hours, which in my opinion is really astonishing. Besides the animal studies mentioned, advances in neuroimaging such as PET also demonstrated that time is a critical predictor of tissue fate and allowed for the quantification of how much brain tissue is lost over time. Now, a highly cited article by Dr. Saver, published in 2006, he quantified how much brain is lost over time and determined that 1.9 million neurons are destroyed each minute.
Yeah, I remember reading that and going, whoa, that sounds like a lot of neurons. 1.9, and I have to put my finger to the side of my mouth, million neurons. It really sounds impressive. But we need to consider how many total neurons do we actually have in our brain? And the current best estimate is 86 billion. Yes, that's with a B. So to put it another way, it would take over 750 hours or 31 days to lose all your neurons. Now, I'm certainly not advocating for the loss of neurons here. But how many neurons must be lost and in what area of the brain to be clinically significant?
That's a great question. And in the same study, it was estimated that each hour without recanalization, the ischemic brain ages 3.6 years. Based on this scientific rationale, it comes as no surprise that time to treatment is a critically important variable predicting outcome. Observed both in a pooled analysis of randomized control trials on TPA and mechanical thrombectomy, not to mention multiple well-designed observational studies.
I absolutely agree that time is important, but we can push the system too fast. And going too fast can lead to increased potential harms. And this has been reported in the STEMI literature in trying to reduce that door-to-balloon time. We do not want to be too slow, but we also don't want to be too fast. We're looking for that Goldilocks zone.
Completely agree. The application of these treatments needs to be done in a safe manner. In centers that push the limits and have achieved excellent door-to-needle times of 20 to 25 minutes, safety was not compromised in those trials as the rates of stroke mimic thrombolysis were low at 1.4% and symptomatic hemorrhage post-thrombolysis was also low at 2.1%.
Well, Michael, that was a lot of talking nerdy. So we got to wrap that part up and now it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
We agree with the author's conclusions.
So can you give us an SGEM bottom line?
Currently, there is insufficient evidence to know what the best strategy for patients with large vessel occlusions is, direct to mechanical thrombectomy or bridging with TPA.
How about resolving the case that you presented at the start of the podcast?
What I really like about this case is it highlights the nuances of the applications of these trials to individual care. There may be many factors that may suggest a bridging approach is the preferred option in this case. First, the patient is presenting at 1.5 hours from stroke onset. Earlier time to treatment with TPA is strongly associated with a better outcome. As we mentioned, neither the direct MT or the DVT trial randomized patients in this early time window.
Well, it is true that there is a strong association, but tissue factors are probably more important than the clock. And in terms of tissue viability, the patient had an aspect score of 10. No early ischemic changes. I mean, 10 out of 10, that's as good as it gets.
The second variable that may favor a bridging approach is the evaluation of this patient is occurring at 1 a.m. and not during standard working hours. It's important to remember that all three trials had a very quick workflow with mechanical thrombectomy occurring after TBA in the DVT and direct MT trials in approximately 30 minutes, while astonishingly, skip trial, 8 minutes. If considerable delays in mechanical thrombectomy are expected, such as on call, a bridging approach may be preferred.
Standard working hours. I love hearing that. The SGEM audience filled with emergency physicians is going to love hearing that. I mean, standard working hours for emergency medicine is 24/7, 365. Patients have acute ischemic stroke at any time. And if there is a more effective and safer therapy, why should it be only offered during, quote, banking hours? Perhaps that means that the revascularization team needs to be available 24/7, 365. In a timely fashion, like we have set up with STEMIs. We still do not know if the drip and ship model will have a patient-oriented net benefit, though.
In many centers, thrombectomy is available 24/7, including where I work, but the reality is even though it may be available, many of those centers, the interventionalists and the techs are at home, it takes time for everybody to arrive to the hospital and set up. Not to mention, there is one neurointerventionalist on call. Rarely, they may be busy with another case. These are the realities that we face and need to be cognizant of them when we are applying the results of trials with excellent workflow characteristics for mechanical thrombectomy.
Absolutely. It always takes place in a context. And I actually went back, being the nerd that I am, and I looked up for stats and found a published study from 2017 in CMAJ Open. And these authors looked at 8 Canadian provinces and estimated that between 85 to 100% of Canadians have access to a current or proposed endovascular thrombectomy site within 6 hours by ground EMS.
Lastly, another variable that may suggest a bridging approach is the preferred option is the patient has a history of peripheral artery disease, if severe, may make it challenging to gain vascular access. As we mentioned, one of the limitations of the DVT trial was that they may have excluded patients like this.
Yeah, and we can't forget about the potential increase in harms because we've been talking about efficacy here. So let's focus in on harms. There's no doubt that bridging approach using TPA increases the risk of symptomatic hemorrhage. The excess risk of symptomatic hemorrhage in all three included RCTs was just under 2%. However, it was not statistically significant, and there was no increase in all-cause mortality.
The risk of symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage needs to be strongly considered before deciding on a bridging approach. There are many clinical, such as high NIHSS score, uncontrolled hypertension, dual antiplatelet therapy, radiological factors such as CT hypodensity, laboratory variables such as hyperglycemia, thrombocytopenia. All these are risk factors for symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhages.
Well, Michael, is there any scoring system that we could use to predict who's more likely to bleed to those who are less likely to bleed?
There are many scores using a combination of the variables that I mentioned used to predict symptomatic ICH post-TPA, but none of them have been applied clinically for two reasons. The first is the scores have only moderate predictability. And the second and more important reason why they haven't been applied clinically is that the variables that predict symptomatic ICH are also associated with benefit from TPA. For instance, high NIHSS score is a consistent predictor of symptomatic ICH, but patients with high NIHSS score also benefit from TPA. I think with the publications of these trials, we have evidence that both approaches are not considerably different in terms of outcome. Sure, there may be indeed be subgroups that benefit more from one approach versus another, which remains to be seen, but overall, the outcomes appear similar. Therefore, we really should consider a direct approach in patients with multiple risk factors for symptomatic ICH. For instance, in a patient with a high NIHSS score, a large clot burden from a tandem occlusion, on dual antiplatelet therapy, as hypertensive and hyperglycemic, in a patient like this, do we want to really risk symptomatic ICH with TPA administration?
Well, let's circle back to the case you presented at the start of the podcast. They had minimal risks for symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage.
Yes, that's true. And so the decision was made to go ahead and offer treatment with TPA while you wait for the endovascular team.
So how are you going to take this information and clinically apply it then?
It would be premature for a general application of a direct mechanical thrombectomy approach, and certainly more data is required. Importantly, as was mentioned by the authors, these trials are only applicable to a mothership model of stroke care.
Well, one of the things I pulled out from this was intervention bias, and it's recognized as an issue in medicine. This type of bias is defined as, quote, bias on the part of the physician and the medical community to intervene, whether it's with a drug, diagnostic test, non-invasive procedures, or surgery, when non-intervening would be a reasonable alternative, end of quote. It's too bad, you know, that we don't have more high-quality evidence to really guide whether we should be using TPA as a bridging therapy for mechanical thrombectomy. Now, this is not an unusual problem in medicine. We often need to rely on our good clinical judgment in applying the limited data that we have.
Certainly, we need to be guided by evidence and need to be careful in rushing too quickly applying RCTs to clinical care, when, as we've been discussing, there are major limitations in these studies.
Exactly. And we're often talking on the SGEM about this knowledge translation gap, this KT window. We commiserate about how it can take over 10 years for that high quality, clinically relevant information to actually reach the patient's bedside. However, new practices can also be adapted too quickly. And we've seen that with things like targeted temperature management for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, and TXA for epistaxis.
My prediction, and this is only a prediction, I could be wrong, is that it is unlikely that there will be a general application of a direct mechanical thrombectomy approach to all cases of large vessel occlusions. Ultimately, we'll have to wait and see. That prediction is based upon the results of two European trials. Mr. Clean No IV was presented in an international stroke conference in 2020, and more recently, the results of Swift Direct were presented this year in the European Stroke Conference. Both failed to show that a direct mechanical thrombectomy approach was non-inferior to the standard of care. Therefore, there are now 3 out of 5 trials that failed to demonstrate non-inferiority. all the European trials failed to show non-inferiority, truly highlights the limitation that we addressed about the external validity of trials conducted in Asia. The fact that multiple trials are failing to show non-inferiority suggests to me some subgroups are benefiting from a bridging approach. There's one other study that's pending called Direct Safe. Ultimately, a patient-level meta-analysis of all studies may address which patients benefit from a direct MT approach versus a bridging approach, likely necessitating an individualized treatment strategy.
Well, we will have to put our skeptical eye upon that systematic review and meta-analysis and consider the quality of the included studies. There's a risk of putting together several open-label or non-blinded trials and that data doesn't get us any closer to the proverbial truth, which is the best point estimate of an observed effect size.
Lastly, another reason that may limit the general applicability of a direct mechanical thrombectomy approach is the fact that in the near future, tenecteplase, which has greater fibrin selectivity and the full dose is conveniently administered quickly as a single bolus, may be adopted as the standard of care. There is some suggestion that TNK may be more effective at lysing large vessel occlusions compared to TPA. In an RCT called Extend TNK, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018, patients with large vessel occlusions prior to mechanical thrombectomy were randomized to either TNK or TPA. The primary outcome was vessel recanalization and a secondary outcome was modified Rankine scale, with an average time to thrombolytic administration of 42 minutes prior to mechanical thrombectomy. TNK was statistically associated with double the recanalization rate prior to mechanical thrombectomy, 22% in TNK versus 10% in TPA, and better clinical outcomes. If TNK does in fact replace TPA in the near future, the question will remain, should we administer TNK prior to mechanical thrombectomy?
Well, Michael, I agree with you. There is a movement towards using TNK for acute ischemic stroke. We do not have good evidence, though, from the STEMI literature of superiority of TNK over TPA for efficacy. The large ASCENT 2 trial, and what I mean by large is almost 17,000 patients, reported no difference in revascularization, equivalence for 30-day mortality between TNK and TPA, but less bleeding with TNK. The Extend IA TNK trial was relatively small compared to the ASCENT 2 trial. It was two orders of magnitude less. It had 202 patients. The trial was partially funded by industry, and there were multiple authors declared financial conflicts of interest, and that does not make the data or the conclusions wrong, but it should make us more skeptical. They had a composite primary outcome of reperfusion of greater than 50% of the involved ischemic territory or an absence of retrievable thrombus at the time of initial angiographic assessment. Both are surrogate markers and not patient-oriented outcomes. There were baseline differences between groups reported in their supplementary index, atrial fibrillation, diabetes, smoking. Now, while the mean score on the ordinal analysis was statistically better with TNK, and that was a secondary outcome, none of the other three patient-oriented secondary outcomes were shown to be statistically different, and that was early neurologic improvement, functional independence, or excellent outcome at 90 days.
I agree. We'll certainly need to wait for more data.
All right, so what are you going to tell the patient?
Well, our patient is aphasic, so if possible, a family member should be called to inform them that their loved one is having a stroke, explaining that there is a blood clot in one of their vessels blocking blood from reaching part of their brain. This is causing them to have severe problems with language and weakness in their face and arm. There are two treatments currently available to treat a stroke. The first is a clot-busting medication called TPA that has been shown to reduce risk of disability in 3 months, but is also associated with serious complication of a brain bleed, about 2-7%, that could be life-threatening. The second treatment is to give the clot-busting drug and then try to retrieve the clot. The clot retrieval procedure, where doctors put a tube inside a blood vessel in the leg, they then thread it up all the way up to the brain. The end of the tube has a special device to remove the clot. The usual practice is to give the combination therapy. The third option would be to go directly to try to retrieve the clot without the clot-busting medication. There's insufficient evidence to know what the best strategy is. What do you want to do?
All right, it's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Eric Izkula. He knew the half-life of dalbavancin is longer than 1 week. The range is actually between 6 and 10 days. Michael, what question do you have for this episode?
What Canadian neurologist is credited as the founder of modern stroke neurology?
If you know the answer to this Keener contest question, with a Canadian twist, I like it, thank you, then send an email to me, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, Michael, thank you for coming to the Bat Cave and talking nerdy with me about acute ischemic stroke and mechanical thrombectomy.
Thanks again for inviting me. That was a lot of fun. I hope to do it again in the near future.
Yeah, we should set up like a stroke summit or something like that. You, me, the Department of Emergency Medicine, the Department of Neurology, and we could all come together. Oh,
that sounds great.
Imagine. You may say. Okay. Well, there's only one last thing to do for this podcast, and that is for the guest, and that's you, the guest skeptic, to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.